Now, I think we all know the phrase politics is the art of the possible, and maybe we imagine it generally applies to domestic politics, but maybe it's also vital to consider in the world of foreign policy, especially challenging right now with so much about American policy we really just don't know yet. Might a German journalist and social agitator from the 19th century have something useful to offer us here? Ludwig von Rockau was the man in question who first coined the term Realpolitik, which has been synonymous with big strategy and ruthlessly pragmatic types like Henry Kissinger. But I'll let British historian John Bew explain why he believes this is a wrong-headed approach to this word Realpolitik, which is far more inviting, he suggests, as a means of grappling with international complexity than it's been given credit for. John Bew's one of Britain's emerging academic stars. He's delved into what he calls the real Realpolitik, described by his hero von Rockau as an enemy of all kinds of self-delusion, ready for partial results if the complete attainment is not achievable for the time being. So to untangle this, I welcome now John Bew, Professor in History and Foreign Policy at King's College London. His book is Realpolitik, A History.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.
So what do you mean by the real Realpolitik?
Well, it's a word, Realpolitik, that we kind of use a lot, and it's been embedded in our foreign policy discourse. In fact, people are hearing a lot about the return of Realpolitik, potentially in American foreign policy, under a president-elect Trump. And even before that, under President Obama, people said that he was the heir to Henry Kissinger's Realpolitik and much less idealistic or controversial in that sense than George W. Bush. So it's a word, you know, we hear almost every day and even finds itself in programs like Game of Thrones. But actually, what I wanted to do is to, you know, basically go back and discover its origins. I discovered that it wasn't as old as statecraft itself. It didn't actually go back to Machiavelli or even the ancient world. It was this weird creation from the mid-19th century. And in that sense, the mid-19th century is very interesting because it's not dissimilar from the world we find ourselves in today. It's a collision of liberal ideals and enlightenment ideals with power politics, military force, new ideas about order and liberty. And so I sort of went back and discovered this man, relatively obscure man, German liberal journalist, as much as anything, had sort of created the term. So I wanted to uncover the real Realpolitik, which dates from 1853 precisely.
Which, of course, was 5 years after the 1848 revolutions. And you say in your book, which was very illuminating, that it was an effort to come to terms with this bitter disappointment, if I'm reading you properly, and to sort of not give up. I mean, akin to some of the commentaries in the aftermath for some people of the Trump victory.
Absolutely. So, you know, in modern history, we tend to start with the French Revolution, which kind of is seen as this great moment of a forward leap and success. 1848 is less sort of present in our story and our consciousness, and yet it's so important for understanding the modern Western mind, because it's a revolution in which history fails to turn. Across Europe, liberal revolutions are put down by dictatorships and other forces. And in fact, I think I compare them in the book to Europe's equivalent of the Arab Spring, really. Revolutions that start with in the name of hope and liberty and actually succumb to all these other forces. And so at its core, Realpolitik is an attempt to make sense of this failure, but it's an attempt to make sense of this failure from a liberal perspective. And I describe Ludwig von Rockau in the book as a liberal mugged by reality. And what he's saying is that we should not abandon our liberal ideals, but even liberals have got to get real about the fact that the world does not move in liberal ways, and history is not some sort of march to progress. And if liberals are to achieve their goals, are to achieve enlightenment values, for example, they have to get real about power, about nationalism, about class, about social order, you know, about all the things that really make history turn. In the modern era, and that's the essence of it.
Well, in fact, you've got In your conclusion, real realpolitik should be distinguished from a cult of the national interest and avoid the traps of fatalism, absolutism and pessimism that have infected some versions of realist thought. So, I mean, look, am I to draw the conclusion that it's been completely turned on its head?
So I started from place when I'm thinking about contemporary foreign affairs. And from around about 2006, when things started to go very bad in Iraq, and Blair in Britain and Bush in America became, criticised almost daily in the news, and this was kind of the constant din of criticism. And much of that was justified, but I was suspicious of this kind of the emergence of these so-called or self-described realists who would enter the political debate and then with a kind of a weariness about everything and tell everyone how the world really works. And I thought it was kind of slightly, intellectually stunted. So going back, I said, what's this word they keep on using? What is this realpolitik? And so when I discovered the original essence of it, it seemed to me a much wiser, a thoughtful credo than a lot of the kind of modern versions of realism, which kind of, as I say, oh, it's all about power, it's all about states clashing, it's inevitable, you're going to have clashes between nations. And I thought, actually, that's not good enough. We can do with something better that sort of leaves some of the silly idealism of the post-Cold War era behind, but actually doesn't, leave those core liberal values behind. So you could describe it as kind of a form of liberal realism. And that's, the oddest thing is to discover that realpolitik itself was very much in tune with my own instincts.
How interesting. In fact, you say that the best, in the many efforts you have to describe it, that it doesn't denote a philosophical mood so much as a method of analysing complex political problems, and that it absolutely required an appreciation of history together with the leadership by people who knew that they weren't on top of the system that they were asked to make decisions about.
Absolutely. That's exactly it. It's not a posture. It's not a kind of a world-weary rolling of the eyes to silly idealism of others. It's analytical. It's a way of analysing political problems, first of all, from a historical perspective, but not simply in a materialist way, not simply to say, who's got power, who's got money, the types of things we associate with Marxism. By the way, he was partly influenced by Marx and he threw a bit of that in, but he thought more broadly about things. And the things that really actuate and get us going as human beings, like mood, public opinion, the spirit of the age, and Rockhart says the zeitgeist, the spirit of the age, is the single most important factor in politics. So rather than this kind of, it was ever thus, approach to international affairs and politics and say, Machiavelli was always right, etc. Actually, Rockhart kind of gets something about modern democratic life that I think is I describe in the book as not only realpolitik, but a higher form of realism. I think it's much more fitted for understanding the modern world.
Well, from a subsequent interview you gave where you tried to apply this, or how he might have applied it, to, say, Syria, or the events since the Arab Spring. And if I, again, understand you correctly, you say that using it properly would have meant not necessarily a grand strategy for the Middle East, but that you would better foretell the events that would come at you, that you weren't therefore seen as reactive or flip-flopping in response to developments, because that just reduces your leverage and your sense of legitimacy. Is that right?
Absolutely. So I think a bit of realpolitik would really have helped those foreign policymakers who are confronted with the breakdown of order in the Middle East, not just in Syria, I would suggest, in places like Egypt as well, with its Arab Spring and Egyptian Revolution, the same in Libya as well. And the first thing, the realpolitik would have looked at would be the sort of balance of forces. So the realpolitik wouldn't have presumed that history would move in a certain way, that Assad would inevitably fall because this seemed to be a progress towards liberal future. But he would have wanted those liberal values and liberal political rights to have been established. So he would have thought, how do we do and how do we achieve that? And rather than rushing to kind of morally absolute positions, rather than kind of pinning your flag to a certain version of history, you would have looked at things like, well, where does power reside? how strong are these regimes? From where do they get their support? You know, does the kid with the iPhone in Tahrir Square represent the future? Or are there 100 conservative, religiously conservative peasants in the countryside who are going to counter them? You know, what does the army believe? What really is the spirit of the time? Is it the iPhone generation? Is it, you know, other things?
So in other words, not by the sound of it, you having a democratic motivation, but not seeing democracies lurking there in all of these places, just waiting to be uncovered.
Exactly. Not abandoning your original goals, but having a more humble and prudent understanding of how you might get towards them.
You say not how can we solve this, but the question should have been how can we manage this in a way which suits our interests. Just tell us a little bit more about this Ludwig Rockau. Who was he?
Well, he's a fascinating character. I mean, he's in some ways it's a bit of a disaster. As I say, he's been ignored in a lot of historical accounts. And I think the reason for that is, and this is what makes him fascinating to me, he doesn't easily fit into our understanding of political traditions. So he's definitely not a Marxist, and yet he reads Marx and applies it to his context. He's a liberal, but as I say, he's a liberal who falls out with all his liberal friends, because he says you've got to change the way you do things. He's not a conservative, and yet he reads conservative thinkers like Edmund Burke. So he's kind of like a bit of a kind of intellectual magpie, and he collects these bits of silver and applies them to this political problem. But he's also kind of a bit of a lunatic when it comes to political action. So he involves himself in one of the most disastrous rebellions in the history of rebellions in Frankfurt in 1833. He gets arrested. And in fact, he's about to kill himself in prison, but he manages to escape and travel around Europe. He goes to France, where there's a lot of German liberal exiles. He travels around Italy. He reads all the books. He goes back to Germany in 1848 and again fails to put himself, get himself elected to the Frankfurt Parliament, to, you know, become the success story he wants to become. And it's slightly this slight loner with a real acute sense of politics and as a journalist that he kind of puts together this odd collection of thoughts, which he titles, you know, his treatise on realpolitik. So he's just kind of like a failed politician, half successful journalist. But I do think he leaves us with first of all, a fascinating word that takes on a life of its own after him. And secondly, I think some real insights into the nature of politics.
Okay, you're obviously interested in people from the perceived sidelines of politics because you've also written another book, you're a busy man, called Citizen Clem, a biography of Attlee. And of course, Clement Attlee was the British Labour MP who did the Trump of his time, who defeated Winston Churchill just a couple of months after World War II was concluded. And he's been described as a sheep in sheep's clothing, a very unromantic hero, and very ineffective in a way at public relations and charisma and so on, yet he achieved enormous things. So what attracted you to him?
Yeah, I kind of like these slightly diffident, shy characters in history. And Attlee, even though, you know, your average Brit does know who Attlee is, doesn't really understand the sort of the texture of his heart and his brain and what made him tick. And Attlee's a hugely important figure in 20th century Britain. I mean, I would argue he's probably, in terms of domestic politics, the most important British Prime Minister of the last 100 years. And I'm sure Thatcher and Blair would potentially challenge that. He's the man who builds the NHS. He's the man who builds the independent nuclear deterrent, who brings Britain into NATO, who builds more houses than any other prime minister, who transforms and creates the welfare state, all in the first 50 years of the Labour Party's existence. And really, I looked at the 20th century and thought there's a bit of an imbalance in our understanding of 20th century Britain because we tend to focus everything through Churchill. Mm. And Attlee's the man who destroys Churchill in the 1945 election in Churchill's finest hour, when Churchill's regarded as a hero by 85% of the British population. They said, they decide, yeah, he's a hero, but, you know, we prefer Attlee and we prefer the vision of his Labour Party.
Well, in fact, in a review of your book, the Labour MP Tristram Hunt in Prospect magazine wrote that there was a humility in his leadership, which people misunderstood because they interpreted it as weakness, but a very rich, clear sense of conviction, I think was the word, a very strong conviction about what Britain could and should be in the world. And he said it's a heck of a long way from where we are now in the Labour Party. Do you agree?
It absolutely could not agree more. The current leader of the Labour Party, to my mind, is a farce and a deeply unimpressive individual who is so far away from the original Attlee tradition, it's almost perverse to think about it. Attlee is a deep patriot, a true socialist, but his socialism is tied to a real sense of nation and what Britain is, and an understanding of rights and responsibility. We tend to talk a lot about our rights these days, but Attlee also stressed duties. And this is a man who volunteered in the First World War. He's carried off the battlefield three times. He's Churchill's deputy in the Second World War. He takes Labour into the coalition because he believes if you don't believe in your nation, you believe in absolutely nothing else. And you can't have social values, fidelity to one's fellow man and woman, unless you have that national unit as well. So he's a kind of a deep patriotic hero, but not a sort of silly flag waver. I mean, he's a man who brings the British Empire to an end. He grants independence to India as well. So, you know, a real kind of modern, ethical patriot who's prepared to criticize his nation and see its flaws and its faults, unlike a lot of people who pretend to be patriots today.
Yes.
But someone who doesn't repudiate his own national story.
No, it's that classic story we talked about this last week, as The Economist did this whole piece on nationalism, about the importance of that glue and that binding capital that is present in patriotism and what they call civic nationalism, which is what, you know, an inclusive form of nationalism, which is really, by the sound of it, what you're talking about.
Absolutely, absolutely. Attlee did not define nation by, you know, creed or colour or class, but by this broader sense of solidarity. And, you know, he's one of a generation for whom, as I say, socialism and nationalism go side by side, because that's what they're an organic unit of people who are bound together by an understanding of rights and responsibilities. And again, I think we sort of pronounce the death of the nation state a little bit too quickly. It's not that nationalism is back. It's that nationalism never went away. It just became sort of unfashionable to talk about it. I think it's much more healthy, in particular in a number of Western societies, if we have a healthier respect for what it's given, you know, modernising nations. Britain is an example, as I'm sure you could talk about Australia in a similar fashion as well. So we kind of lost the ability to talk about nationalism, and I think, you know, Attlee helps us get back into that.
So what comes next for you in this sort of development of your thought, which is very interesting? Are you working on more that you would discuss?
Hopefully to write a big book on this whole broad question of world order. So really to combine some of these themes, some of the Attlee themes of the building of NATO and the United Nations with the realpolitik themes as well, and to do sort of a big, you know, history of the 21st century so far and what it means for global affairs, for which, of course, Australia is a significant actor squeezed between America and China and this rapidly changing world.
Indeed, we know it. John Bew, it's been a pleasure to talk to you, and we'll talk again, no
doubt.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
John Bew, B-E-W. His book is Realpolitik, A History, and the publisher is Oxford University Press.